Number four, which is 103934, Damasco versus Clearwire Corporation. And once again, I need to figure out who was here and who wasn't when we explained that the lights aren't working and that construction paper has taken its place of electricity. Yeah, we're like the Amish in here. I don't know. All right. Mr. McMurro.
Thank you, Your Honor. May it please the Court, good morning. My name is Mike McMurro, and I'm here today representing the appellant in this case, Jerome Damasco. Your Honors, we raise 3 points on appeal. First, this Court should clarify that a defendant's immediate settlement offer only to a class representative in a class action cannot moot that class action. Secondly, in the alternative, the Court should apply the inherently transitory exception to mootness and relate back the class certification motion to the date of the filing of the complaint. And third, finally, even if the Court doesn't rule on one of those two bases, the Court should overturn the lower court's denial of reconsideration because the lower court here reached contradictory decisions on identical facts in similar cases.
You know, you seem to concede that we would have to overrule Holstein in order to find in your favor.
Well,
but you never come right out and say it. And so I'm going to put you on the spot. Would we have to overrule Holstein?
No, I don't think so, Your Honor. I think to the extent that this court construes Holstein to mean exactly what the lower court and the defendant construe Holstein to mean, then I think you would. However, I think Holstein is distinguishable in at least two ways. First, I'd like to note the facts of Holstein are a little bit unclear. But it does appear that the plaintiff in that case who was mooted out, Mr. Grove, at the time that he filed his suit, he was in the middle of a municipal hearing over his toe in Chicago. It's unclear to me whether Mr. Grove even had standing at the time he filed the suit to complain of the constitutional violation that he complained of. As the opinion makes clear, that municipal hearing in the city of Chicago was resolved shortly after he filed suit and in his favor. So it's unclear whether he ever suffered the constitutional deprivation that he complained of in the complaint. And if he hadn't, then he wouldn't have had standing in the first place. Secondly, the law has developed in the 17 years since the Holstein case came down. First of all, as we note in the briefs, several other circuits have considered this exact question and have decided on a number of different bases that the immediate tender to the named plaintiff will not moot a class action. Secondly, there have been changes in the class certification process since then. First of all, there were changes to Rule 23 itself in 2003, and I think more importantly, at the time that Holstein was decided, it seems like it was decidedly easier to file an early class certification motion because a lot of judges were of the opinion at the time that they could simply rule on class certification based on the allegations of the complaint. And Rule 23, as it existed at that time, suggested that was possible. Rule 23 was changed in 2003 to explicitly state that class certification isn't to be made at the earliest practicable time, but at an early practicable time after the filing of the complaint. And this court in the Szabo versus Bridgeport Machines stated that a district court can't certify a class based only on the pleadings, and that the court must make whatever factual and legal inquiries are necessary.
But why is it absurd to expect class action named plaintiffs to move for certification at the same time they file the complaint? I mean, is there any reason that a plaintiff who needs discovery couldn't ask the court to delay ruling on the certification until some limited discovery has been completed?
Well, Your Honor, as the Szabo case makes clear, and as the Supreme Court's recent adoption of that in Dukes versus Walmart makes clear, you have to present evidence to the court in order to certify a class. Now, if the plaintiff files a class certification motion, if that really is the bright line rule, the defendant would be, I think, perfectly justified in simply responding without any evidence of their own to a skeletal class certification motion.
Yeah, but you're not answering my question. A plaintiff can ask a court to allow discovery before ruling on the motion. So your objection doesn't really seem genuine to me. Am I wrong?
Well, I think so, Your Honor.
You can't ask the court, look, we need some limited discovery. Could you just wait?
You can certainly.
A few months? Judge, please.
You can certainly wait. You can certainly ask the court for that for some time to take discovery.
Right.
But the class certification motion itself, it asks for nothing other than what the complaint already asks for.
But it would certainly give your concern is these pick-off situations,
right.
And if you get that motion on file, you've immunized yourself from that. You've protected the class interests regardless of what the defense wants to offer your individual client.
But my point, Your Honor, is that if you file a class certification motion, there are requirements to filing a motion. The motion has to be founded on some good faith basis. Now, there are cases where
Same allegations are made in your complaint.
The allegations are made in the complaint, but the allegations are backed up or not backed up through the discovery process. And, you know, there are...
So you ask for a few months to take discovery. No?
Well, I think that would put an incredible burden on the lower courts here.
What?
If there were a class certification motion filed along with the complaint in every case, these cases would, as the lower courts of this circuit see, the lower courts would simply... Enter those motions, keep them on their docket. They'd be mere placeholders.
It's hard to see what the burden is, how that's any more burdensome than having a complaint that alleges a class. If there's nothing for the court to do with it for this gap period of time.
But if, Your Honor, if there's no evidence that's brought along with the class certification motion, if it's filed in a skeletal way along with the complaint, there's nothing more to the motion other than legal argument than there is to the complaint. And as this court and the Supreme Court has held, you have to be able to back that up with evidence as well.
When it is to be resolved, what your concern in this case, though, are the pickoffs, not how the class certification ends up. You're trying to keep it alive and avoid having your people bought out from under you. That is
certainly what we're asking, Your Honor, and we think this court's precedents themselves suggest that is something that's to be discouraged and possibly prohibited by the courts since the time of the Sussman case. Sussman versus Lincoln American stated that if the class action device is to work, courts must have a reasonable opportunity to consider and decide a class certification motion.
Well, we just gave you a way to do it, but you don't like our way or something.
Well, that I suppose, Your Honor, that setting a rule that class certification motions must be filed with the complaint in order to avoid mootness, it would give a clear rule, but the interests of the class are already brought before the court when the complaint is filed.
Which of our cases has suggested that Holstein isn't our clear rule?
Well, I think I think there are several that suggest that Holstein isn't a clear rule.
Which ones are those?
For one thing, I think Reitzel versus Cook County suggests that it's not a clear rule. In the Reitzel case, which is a 2010 case, The court suggested that an involuntary settlement is an exception to mootness, and in that case, the court, and this is at page 783 of that opinion, it cited approvingly to several of the other circuits which have disallowed these type of pickoffs. It cited approvingly to both Sandoz versus Singular Wireless out of the Fifth Circuit, and also to Weiss versus Regal Collections out of the Third Circuit.
Are now, you cited in your brief? I'm just glancing at it.
Reitzel is cited repeatedly in both of our briefs. I don't know the exact page numbers, but it's cited throughout. So that's one case that suggests that that's not a clear rule.
Forgive me, you were looking that way, and that came up.
I'm sorry. In addition, there have been other cases that have suggested that this isn't necessarily a clear rule. If you look at Gates versus Towery, which is an opinion I believe you wrote, Judge Rovner, that at least suggests that this is an open question. It states that we need not decide whether and if so. I'm sorry. You were on that panel. Judge Easterbrook wrote that opinion.
But you never tell Judge Easterbrook that. You know that, don't you?
I'm sorry, Your Honor.
Because Judge Easterbrook, really, I'm giving you all some advice today. He always says you never mention who wrote it because it's the court's opinion.
No, I'm
so
sorry.
I don't know that. I'm just telling you.
He's not sitting here.
He's up on the 27th floor doing his thing.
Gates suggests that this is also an open question. Gates states, nor need we decide whether and if so when defendants are entitled to pay off representative plaintiffs and decapitate the class. Now, this was decided in, I believe, 2005, which is 11 years after Holstein, and so I think that case itself suggests that Holstein is not necessarily the rule that the lower court decided that it is.
So should we overturn Holstein? I'm going to end how I began.
Well, like I said, Your Honor, to the extent that the court decides, interprets Holstein in the same way that the lower court did here, then yes, I think it needs to be overturned. To the extent, however, that the case can be limited to its facts, and I think there are several ways that it can, or distinguished based on subsequent changes in the law, then I think it should be held to its facts or distinguished.
Okay.
I'll reserve the rest of my time for rebuttal. Thank you.
And how much time is left?
3 minutes.
Okay. Because you were smart enough to reserve 5. Hello. How are you, Mr. Blocker?
Good morning, Your Honor. It's Mark Blocker on behalf of Defendant Clearwire Corporation. I'm going to start with Judge Robner's question because that is really the heart of the matter. In our view, this court should affirm the district court because it had correctly applied this court's precedents not only in the Holstein case but also in the Grice case, which came 6 years later, and the Primax case, which came 4 years after that. All of those decisions hold that an offer of complete relief to a putative class plaintiff moots the case if the offer is made before the plaintiff has moved for class certification. And this rule makes sense because, as this court noted in the Grice case, the filing of a class motion is the time when the interests of absent class members are first brought before the court. And make no mistake about it, Judge Rovner and the other members of the panel, the plaintiff is asking you to overrule not just Holstein, but also Grice and also Primax, all of which have this same doctrine in it, making an offer of settlement before a class certification motion is filed.
Your offer was not just to Mr. Damasco, but to up to 10 others?
The offer was extended beyond Mr. Damasco, but for our purposes here, there never was anybody beyond Mr. Damasco.
Right, but the allegations of the complaint are a class of others who've been affected by the same texting.
That was the allegation, yes.
And so are you really offering complete relief if you're just saying, well, you 11, Damasco, and up to 10 others, is that really complete relief?
We are offering complete relief because all that, in terms of whether we've offered complete relief, the only measuring stick is, have we offered complete relief to the named plaintiff? If it comes at a time before a class certification is sought, before a motion is filed, an offer to the named plaintiff, this court has held 3 times, moots a case. It doesn't matter that we also made the offer to others. We went beyond what was required to moot this particular case. But
if you truly believed that the case was moot as soon as you offered a settlement in state court, why did you remove the case? What sense did it make to remove a mooted case?
Well, Your Honor, we had
some bad law in Illinois on that pickoff concept, didn't you, at that time?
No.
Was there an Illinois appellate court case that subsequently got...
This is the way I would size it up, Judge Tinder, is at the time that we removed, we only have 30 days to decide a removal. So a defendant has to decide immediately, do I want to be in federal court or do I want to be in state court? Whatever the resolution of that Illinois dispute, as you're putting it, I'll come back to that in a second, was going to be, we didn't have enough time to make a motion and have that dispute weigh itself out. We had to make a decision in 30 days. That's the rule. So we made a decision to remove. There was no reason to believe at the time that the rule would have been different in state court than it would have been in federal court, because these three cases I mentioned at the outset all said that if a case is in federal court and an offer is made before a class certification motion is filed, then the claim is moot. But I don't think it would have mattered if the case had stayed in state court, because while there was an appellate court opinion that was under review, Your Honor, there was an earlier Supreme Court decision, a 1983 Illinois Supreme Court decision, called Wheatley versus Board of Education, which had specifically held that an offer of settlement made before a class certification motion was filed mooted the claim. So really all the Illinois Supreme Court had to decide was the same thing this court has to decide, which is whether it was going to follow its precedent or overrule it. So while the Barber case ultimately in the first district was overturned, and that was true at the time, it ultimately shouldn't have mattered where this case was. And to your point, Your Honor, we couldn't find any authority one way or the other that says whether you're permitted to remove a moot case. There's nothing out there. We've looked before we filed our brief.
It's just common sense, isn't it?
Well, I'm not sure, because the mootness determination, we're making the mootness determination, right, Your Honor? I mean, ultimately, it's the people wearing the robes that get to decide. All we believe is we have a good argument.
You understand something one of the last litigants didn't.
So we may have thought we had a very good argument that the claim was moot, but we certainly were entitled to remove the case in order to, have that issue tested in federal court.
Listen, I want to know something. It really is. You know, how can an identically worded offer be definite enough for acceptance in one case for a judge and not definite enough in another?
Your Honor,
I'm going to ask when we're all done with this, but I can't ask now, if you understand.
Yeah. The plaintiff did move for reconsideration on the grounds that something that happened in another case that involved another defendant and that ultimately involved different counsel somehow impacted our case.
Well, because it's an identically worded offer. Is it? It's absolutely identical.
But as I understand what took place in the Fahey case, and again, we were not involved. It's a different defendant. It would be very odd to make Clearwire bear the water of some decision in another case. But keep in mind, there were different circumstances about what happened after that identically worded offer was made. There was an attempt to accept the offer. There was a replacement of counsel. The new counsel came in and claimed that the offer wasn't exactly... It was very different than what happened with respect to Mr. Damasco and Clearwire. But the bottom line, Your Honor, is it's very hard to see how Judge Zagel could be found by this court to have erred by making a decision in a different case for a different defendant involving a different counsel, ultimately. Why that should impact the decision Judge Zagel made with respect to Clearwire doesn't make any sense at all to me. And ultimately, Judge Rovner, you, I think, are putting your finger on something that would be a very odd outcome. I mean, this claim was moot when it was filed in state court. We now know that quite surely, because the Illinois Supreme Court in Barber ruled that, exactly as this court has, that offers of complete relief made before a plaintiff has filed a motion for class certification moots a claim. So it would be very odd to say that a claim that was dead in the water in state court somehow got revived by the simple fact that Clearwire had to remove it to federal court. But you don't have to get there, Your Honors, to affirm in favor of Clearwire, because ultimately, as I said, this court has said three times that the exact same rule exists in the Seventh Circuit, and it should continue to be the law, and I don't see any reason that that should be overruled.
You know, I realize that the settlement offer here wasn't made pursuant to Rule 68, but is your argument any different in cases where the offer is a Rule 68 offer of judgment?
Well, let me address that two ways, Your Honor. First of all, remember, this case was filed in state court. Under Illinois state court practice, there is no Rule 68 analog, so all we're permitted to do is make a settlement offer, so that's what we did. Whether it would make a difference if this was a Rule 68 offer, if we had waited until we got to federal court, I don't know what the answer to that would be. I don't see why it would make a difference, but I would only caution Your Honors, it really isn't germane to the outcome here because we never made and never had the ability to make in state court a Rule 68 offer of judgment. So I don't think that makes any difference ultimately because they're both forms of settlement offers. And in some of the cases that we've talked about, the Grice case was a Rule 68 offer, so I don't think the Seventh Circuit, this court, has distinguished between that before. And I think in Primax, there was no Rule 68 offer, and in Holstein, it was just a straight-out settlement. So at least for purposes of the three instances where this court has, you know, held the way we think it should hold, it hasn't seemed to matter that it's a Rule 68 offer versus an offer of settlement.
Do you agree that a number of other jurisdictions do not agree with Holstein's holding?
Do I agree that other circuits have gone a different way? Yes, other circuits have gone a different way. I would submit, Your Honors, I will
give... Are there smarter circuits?
No, this is the smartest circuit in the land.
I will take judicial notice. Judicial notice of that.
Just one? No.
Let me just course through them quickly. I mean, in the Ninth Circuit, in the case which is quite appropriately called Pitts versus Terrible, both because it's the Pitts and it's a terrible decision, the court ended up finding that the claim was one that was inherently transitory. And under this court's precedence, or any court's precedence, I would submit, there is no basis to find that these sort of claims are inherently transitory. And if you did, you'd basically be saying all class action claims are inherently transitory, and you'd be turning a rule, an exception, something that was supposed to be a narrow exception, into a broad rule. It's the proverbial exception swallowing the rule, if I can use a phrase. As to the other two cases, the Weiss case and the Lucero case from the Tenth Circuit, both of those, they pay more attention to the principles behind Rule 23 than they do to the case and controversy requirement, which is constitutional. And I would submit, Your Honors, that while class actions certainly play an important role in the litigation society, that it shouldn't be paramount, that ultimately what we're here to decide is what does the Constitution require. The Constitution requires case and controversy, and three times this court has correctly held that there is no case or controversy if the offer of complete relief is made before class certification is sought. And as Your Honors have all pointed out, it's not as if we're asking for some Herculean task here. It is not hard to file a motion for class certification. And if you're wondering if any discovery was needed in this case, the record proves no discovery was needed because the minute we removed this case to federal court, Mr. Damasco's counsel immediately filed a full-blown motion for class certification with a substantial supporting brief. And we would have been required to respond to that. And as Your Honors have all pointed out, if he thought he needed additional discovery to back that up, he could have asked the court for additional discovery, just like he would do in a summary judgment proceeding where you file a 56F affidavit. It's really no different. But no discovery was needed here. He thought he could prove that he was entitled to have a class certified out of the box. He just waited too long to do it before an offer of complete relief was made. So, you know, we would ask Your Honors, I can't see any reason, Your Honors, to overturn your prevailing precedent, and we would ask Your Honors to affirm the district court. And unless there's any other questions, I'll sit down.
Thank you,
Your Honors.
Okay, Mr. McMurrow, you have 3 minutes.
Thank you, Your Honor. I'd like to raise a few points in rebuttal. First of all, you asked about whether you could file a class certification motion with the complaint and then simply ask the judge for discovery. And Mr. Blocker has said, well, they filed a substantial class certification motion. And I'd suggest that it was substantial in terms of the law related to class certification, but not of the facts. There are facts that we still don't know about that would be extremely relevant to the certification of this class under Rule Federal Rule 23. And if we filed a class certification motion, bare bones, and we asked the court for time to take discovery, the court wouldn't have to say yes. The court could simply say no and rule on the papers as it were, in which case my class action would be defeated substantively in a much more substantive way than it would be by the pick-off attempt made by the defendant. The next point I'd like to raise is that the settlement offer is not complete relief. As the Supreme Court recognized in the Roper case, and in particular, then Justice Rehnquist's concurrence in that case, a settlement offer in a class action is not all the relief that's requested in the complaint unless it includes relief for the class. And that was requested here. It was relief for the class. What that makes clear, if it weren't already, is that an offer such as the one by the defendant here is not really an offer, and it's not really a settlement offer. It's simply an attempt to defeat a class action without having to face it. And Roper cautions against that. And the concurrence in Roper explicitly says that's not something that's available. Judge Rovner, you asked about the two offers here in these two cases. These were the same letter written by the same lawyer, and the wording was almost identical. The biggest difference between them was the name of the plaintiff that it was addressed to.
Is it possible that, you know, the judge had a change of mood or mind or thought?
I don't see how that's possible. We're talking about exactly the same circumstances in each case. The discussion in the lower court on this case and on Fahey were going on simultaneously. And so the lower court's decision on the interpretation of the contract is at odds with itself. This same letter from Mr. Murphy was sent out twice. It was only accepted once, and on the time that it was accepted, that case is still pending before Judge Zagel. So I think Judge Zagel's ruling in this case that the meaning of the letter was absolutely clear. It's belied by the evidentiary hearing that he held in Fahey. It's belied by the actions of Mr. Murphy in this case. And it's irreconcilable with Fahey, and it should be overturned. I see that I'm out of time.
Yes.
Thank the court for its
time.
Thank
you very, very much to all parties, and the case will be taken under advisement. Whatever that is. Now, we are going to go on to case number